So we're just coming up on 7:30 right now, so I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to mute all. As usual, you'll have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or question, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck, the chat, and the audio track will be available on our website, along with all of the previous Q&A sessions that we've had for the last few years. So with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chris, and welcome everybody to this week's edition of Q&A. And if you weren't watching the pre-meeting deck, it turns out I believe this is the 196th session that we've put on. We've covered 1,390 topics and had more than 7,000 participants in the few years that we've been doing this. Okay, so we have a few items this week. One is quite long, I think. But to start off, we've got a follow-up on the poll that Chris did last week.
Okay, thanks, Alan. You didn't give me slide control, I don't think.
I have to figure out how to do it.
Okay. So last week we did have a poll, and what we were interested in finding out is that people would be interested in the option to have one-on-one assistance. And this would be remotely, either over Zoom or Windows Quick Assist. And so basically there was two questions in it. It was just, are you interested or not? And then some options down there of things that people might want to think about as to whether they would be interested in having that ability or not. So.
I think you now have control, Chris.
Yeah, thought so, but okay, let me try this one.
Yes.
Okay, there we go. Okay, so 38 people were in attendance when the poll was taken. And 32 of the people responded to the poll. The three hosts or co-hosts at the time, they can't respond. So it was pretty good response on it. And we certainly had a very strong interest in having one-on-one support. So 94% of the people who responded were positive on that front. And then the interests were pretty broad, right across the spectrum of the ones that we presented there. So it seems like there definitely is an awful lot of interest. So given that there is strong support for it, that we're definitely going to pursue it further. And we are going to be seeking volunteers. So those people who would be willing to provide remote assistance to other people in the user group who need it. And, you know, it can be very broad or very narrow. So you don't have to be a generalist. You could just be interested in helping out with whatever you can help out with. So it could be as broad as something like just anything in PowerPoint or anything with email, or you can help with Linux and looking at you, Alan. And or somebody's trying to set up backup. Well, maybe these people have experience with backup and can help with that. It can be anything at all, really. And so the aim of this calling out for volunteers is that we want to build up a list of volunteers who are interested in being able to provide this assistance on a case-by-case basis, of course. And so what we would do is if we had a request for assistance come in, then we would be able to go out to either a known person with that expertise or just going out to the entire list of people that have offered for to give assistance and just say, can anybody help with this particular person? And then so if you do want to volunteer to be available to help other people, send it into suggestion box at opcug.ca. You can let us know exactly what you think that you might be able to help with, or if you just wanted to be available for if an interesting question comes up that you say, hey, I know a little bit about that. You could just say that, you know, if something comes up that there's a request that comes in, please include me on the list of people that it's asked, you know, can anybody help? So after we compile this list of volunteers, so don't flood us in right now with requests for assistance, but after we compile that list of volunteers, anybody looking for assistance could write into suggestionbox@opcug.ca saying that, you know, what are the specific details of the problem they need assistance with. Try to be as specific as you possibly can, include as much information as possible, and that will help us match up somebody who might be able to resolve that. Also include anything that you have already tried to resolve the issue so we don't have people coming in with suggestions of things that you've already tried. Then we will try to find a volunteer who can help. Okay. When we find a volunteer who is interested in helping out, the volunteer will contact the person who requested assistance, and then the two of them can work out the best date, time, any terms of engagement, whatever is required. Assistance is likely going to be provided over either Windows Quick Assist or Zoom. Quick Assist seems to be a little bit easier to get up and running with, but Zoom is an option as well. Both of those will allow for either remote viewing, so the person helping out can just see the person's screen and say, okay, click on this or click on that or try this or run this or whatever. But they also both allow for remote control where with the person's permission who's requested assistance, they can allow the person giving assistance to actually operate their keyboard and mouse to actually do functions for on their behalf. So the fine print on this, it will be available only to OPCUG members. So that'll be a new thing. Most of our services in the OPCUG are available to guests. This will not be available to guests. The requesters should make sure they're as specific as they possibly can be when they request assistance. Just make it easier for us to actually provide that assistance. And I think consider whether Q&A can provide adequate answers. So try a Q&A first, and if for some reason you can't get a response that you're comfortable with, then you could take it to the one-on-one. Volunteers who are giving assistance as well as people requesting assistance will be expected to provide feedback so that we know how the program is working and whether it needs to be adjusted in any way at all. A very important point, the OPC cannot accept responsibility for a negative outcome. The idea is that we are the volunteers, they are volunteers, they are going to be doing the best they can, but as with any operation like this, the possibility is that something will go wrong. So if something goes wrong, we're sorry. You know, we will help you out as best we can to get out of that situation. But, yeah, we can't accept responsibility. You can't come to, back to us and say, oh, you have to get me a new computer or, you know, you have to then pay for me to take it to a repair shop to fix or whatever. And the volunteers would be strongly encouraged to do the same thing. And that's basically it. So, again, if you're interested in being able to provide assistance to others, send it into suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And over the next couple of weeks, hopefully we will get a list of people, and then we can move forward with allowing people to send in requests for assistance. And that's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Yeah, just to underline there that
you're really breaking up there, Alan.
It should be specific. And I mean, don't say you need help with security. Wait, I use what I can do about that, Chris.
Yeah,
maybe you can say I use Windows Defender, but is my sound breaking up?
Yeah, you're fine right now, but you have been breaking up a bit.
This internet connection is something else. It works fine, and then all of a sudden it doesn't. I don't understand it. What I was trying to say was you really need to be specific and don't say that you need help with internet security because that's way too broad. But if you say, I use Windows Defender, but I'd really like to check with a third party and one-time scan, how do I do that? Then somebody's going to be able to help you with that. Okay, so we need to have lots of people writing in, volunteering, and telling us what they can volunteer with. Okay, so one other thing, Chris had asked if I'd given him slide control. He found a new wrinkle in Zoom just recently where the person who's sharing the screen, normally I will be changing the slides and Chris will be saying, you know, next slide, next slide. But the person who's running the screen now has the ability to give a slide control to somebody else. So for that last session, I gave Chris slide control. So he was actually changing the slides on my computer. So if anybody's interested in making a presentation and you don't want to run it from your own computer, you have the slides in the regular deck. I will show the PowerPoint session on my computer, but I'm happy to give somebody control so you can change the slides, and it makes for a smoother presentation, I think. Okay, so next up, I have one of these fraud alert issues. I haven't been receiving spam recently, but then just the other day, I suddenly got a whole bunch of scam emails in very quick. And the first one is being right here. You'll see it's coming from this guy, Chris, and the interesting email address is logicast.info here. Well, Logicast in Calgary, which is also a legitimate company. Again, probably nothing to do with Christopher Ralph, and I don't know anything about Kananaskis Lodge. I don't deal with Chinook pumps. So why they are sending me a payment, notice I've got a vendor payment, electronic funds transfer, is being remitted account to my account today. I wonder how much. Maybe I should click on this PDF file and find out. Except when I look at the link, all I do is I hover over the link, and here it says that the link isn't a PDF file at all. It's this long URL. At cafe24.com is the main part of the URL. And then way down the end, off the screen here, it's a really long URL, is my email address embedded in the link. So clearly there, this is a phishing expedition, and one of us is not going to be receiving an answer, or one of us isn't going to be very happy. Two of us aren't going to be very happy because I'm not happy to get the emails, and this guy is not going to be happy because he doesn't get a reply. And then I get a second email with a deposit of some kind, another PDF file. But it's, again, it's the same guy, same scammer, and the same link at cafe24.com. And then the third email, these are all but almost instantaneous. And this one's interesting. It's coming from DocuSign. Now, DocuSign is a real company. And they send documents for signature, but they didn't send this one. Because again, if I hover over this view the completed document, which is a link they obviously want you to click, and you notice that the URL is the same old URL at cafe24.com. So clearly these are all scams. And then there's another one, and now I'm really annoyed now. Now I've gone through three or four of these and I'm having to delete them. However, I have a fix. And the fix goes like this. Call up Thunderbird, and you tell Thunderbird to create a filter from the message. And I choose that the from category in the message is going to contain this logicKananaskis.whatever. If it contains logicKananaskis, that will trip all three of those messages that came in earlier. And then I say, if that match is made, then move the message to, and I choose the folder, and I go through the list here, and I choose trash. Just send the message immediately to trash. I don't want to see it. I don't want to know about it. Because the next thing, of course, is that the other thing I can do in Thunderbird, in the settings, is I can set the message storage to empty the trash when I exit the Thunderbird email program. So if you think about what's happening now, messages are coming in from this larger Canascus email address. They're being sent immediately to trash. And then when I get out of Thunderbird, all the messages in trash are deleted. So that solves my problem with this particular spammer. Okay.
I'd like to point out before we go on, too, that the filters are not unique to computer-based mail programs such as Thunderbird. Gmail has it, Outlook.com has it, Yahoo Mail has it. So even pure web-based ones, you can go in, you can do filtering on messages.
Okay, have we lost the connection?
No, I've got you.
All right. Filters are really useful because you can filter things. You don't have to send it to trash. You can send it to anything. So, for example, I have a couple of folders in my email system. One is called Alan and one is called Carol. And we share an inbox, but messages from the OPCUG, for example, I filter those and send them to my inbox. And some things that Carol's interested in, I filter those and send them to her inbox. So we kind of get a first cut at looking at email, and we don't have to read stuff that we're not particularly interested in. So it's a very flexible, very powerful system for managing your inbox in your email system. Okay, next up we have an item that's going to burn up lots of Ontario power. Chris is going to tell everybody how to use chatbots.
Thanks, Alan. Yeah, Perplexity, we were introduced here at Q&A by Bob Harris to Perplexity AI, and he's also going to be doing a main meeting in December talking about chatbots and differences between different types of chatbots and so forth. So I've been really, really impressed with Perplexity AI. So I had a problem, this was actually on Linda's computer, where the Thunderbird email client seemed to be acting up. There were a few emails, not many. She had maybe, over the course of a month, she had two or three where the email wasn't displaying correctly. And so the body of the email would not show anything, or it would just show some unrelated graphic like a thumbnail of her or something completely unrelated to the email itself. And if I went into view and message source, normally you have very structured text come up where it has the headers of the email and then the body of the email, which may be an HTML code in that, but it was very logically structured. And it would just show random data. It was not even words. It was just, hex codes and everything like that. So obviously there was something displaying wrong. And so I went in and the events. There we go. I was kind of unsure how to ask Google for a solution. And one of the things about Google in the search is that typically people search very, very short things. The average length of a Google search is 1.9 words and 8.5 characters long. So people tend to have very, very abbreviated searches that come up or that they propose to Google. And I was kind of unsure how to actually go ahead and put in a query that would come up with something useful in Google. So I decided, well, let's try to provide a lot of information to Google. So I said, in the Thunderbird email client, I have some messages not displaying correctly. I did suspect that there might be corruption somewhere in the message database. I don't know. Then I asked, is it possible? Or an index, and how could I actually repair it? And Google actually did an admirable job of coming back, as it usually does. So I had things like the first hit. It said, Thunderbird 11590, messages disappearing. Not sure really what it means by disappearing. So let's see what else we had. A corrupted mail database blows up Thunderbird. Well, Thunderbird wasn't really blowing up, whatever that means. Indexing messages forever. Well, I didn't think there was a problem. It didn't seem to be a performance issue. How do I fix Thunderbird email problems? Well, that sounds okay, but it's rather generic, and it could include an awful lot of things not related to what it is that I was experiencing. I seriously need help with corrupt installation or something. Well, probably not an installation problem because this was installed a long time ago, but I certainly do have a problem with something, just don't know what. And then I had one for, problem with emails getting corrupted. It was on Ubuntu. Well, I'm running on Windows. So is that going to be related or not? I really don't know. And then here's one where messages disappearing might be, related to it. Is this specific to a particular version, 105.9.0? I don't know. And then this one here where, yeah, it sounds relevant, can't open old emails, but, it's really happening on new messages. So is this related or not? So through all of that, I'm kind of puzzled by it. And then lastly on here, it says help emails show up in search, but I can't find them nowhere. Well, it's not really a problem of searching on emails unless, of course, if I happen to know the body of this message that wasn't showing up, could I search on it? I really don't know. So Google, while it comes back with an awful lot of stuff, it's not really actionable. So the answer is there somewhere, I'm sure. So I could go through all of those links and try to find out, is this link relevant to what it is that I'm having a problem with, or is it going to be all unrelated information? Also, I have to be really careful to weed out bad information. You don't want to make a bad situation worse where you start with a few corrupted messages and then you end up losing all your emails or something like that. And sometimes it can be difficult to actually weed out bad information. So I decided to query Perplexity AI. And one of the nice things about it is that they actually do welcome long, free-form descriptions of the problem and what it is you're looking for. The more information you provide to Perplexity AI, it seems the better results that you're going to get. So I put in the exact same query into Perplexity that I put into Google. And I got back structured answers. And this is really, really handy. So let's take a look through here. So the answer is highlighted at the top and it's summarized. So corruption in the message database or indexes can indeed cause messages to display incorrectly. Okay. So then, it had three possible causes. And notice that one of the things I really like about Perplexity AI is that they do reference where they got the information from in their answers. So they have footnotes on there, and it'll point to specific websites. So you can look at those particular websites, you can jump to them, or you can even just look and see, is this a trustworthy source? Support.mozilla is probably going to be more trustworthy than the next one over, Reddit. Yeah. Now, Reddit has a lot of good information too, but I think that support.mozilla is probably going to be better. It is all nicely structured, so we have the repair methods listed down there, and there's clear answers about what you can try. It pulls the relevant information from multiple sites. You see here, it actually had 8 sources that they found information that they thought was relevant to the problem that I was having, and it's really easy to navigate that information. So, is Perplexity AI better than Google Search? Again, I think that Google Search, the information was there. It was just not all that easy to find the information I was looking for. And Perplexity actually encourages lots of information in the query. You can do follow-up queries, which will just expand on the information you've already provided. It surfaces that relevant information in very clear and concise information. Very focused. There's very rarely any chaff. It's usually all relevant to what it is I'm looking for. And so I find that it is actually really, really good. You can't trust it 100%. Perplexity AI is not immune to the standard AI hallucinations out there where it'll all of a sudden go off in the middle of nowhere. So you really should look at the sources where they found it and see if it all makes sense to you. As it turns out, The solution that they provided was very quick and easy, and it did fix the problem. It was just a couple of clicks, and the problem went away. So very, very happy with Perplexity AI, and I highly encourage anybody to use it when you're searching for problems, solutions to problems.
And as Tom notes, that Microsoft Copilot also provides references.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
But things like ChatGPT do not, right?
I don't think it does, but it's been a while since I've been on ChatGPT. ChatGPT is actually the driver behind a lot of these. I think Perplexity AI actually uses ChatGPT at the back end, but it just, you know, presents the results in a better format than ChatGPT does. And Copilot would be the same thing because Microsoft invested billions of dollars in ChatGPT or OpenAI. And I think what they really did, the billions were really in services. So they provide a lot of web services to ChatGPT.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So that's perplexity.ai for people to try. And if you don't want to use the big boys in terms of chatbots, here's an opportunity to run your very own chatbot on your local computer. And you know that most of the AI chatbots are available on the web, and you just use your browser to access them. Some of them are free, and others require a subscription. The ones that are free, are they always going to be free? That's another good question. They're free right now, but they may not always be free. One of the things that strikes me about these chatbots is that they basically know everything. They know everything there is to know, and you can ask them any question, and it will come up with an answer. And as Tim mentioned early on in the pre-meeting, these AI chatbots are just eating up electrical power and resources like crazy because everybody's asking them all these things. Personally, one of the things I like chatbots for is to do programming and do coding. So it would be really nice if I had a chatbot that knew how to program in Python. That's all I need. I just need the bot to know about Python, and I don't need to know about Henry VIII's wives and how to cook hamburgers to medium well or something. So what I'm looking for is just a tiny chatbot that knows everything there is to know about Python programming, but it would run locally on my PC, so I wouldn't have to have the internet connection and run these big server farms to answer my questions. So learning from Bob Harris and Chris, I asked perplexity.ai, which large language models are open source? So this is going to be something that's because people will maintain these things. I want it to be specific to programming in Python, and I want it to run on PC. And as you see, I've got a bunch of references there. I got several answers. And I decided I would pick on this one right here, mainly because I'd seen a video from Gary Explains talking about how to run this thing. So I thought I would give it a whirl. And you notice it says it's a tool, a Llama. This thing will run on my PC. And the second thing is it has a thing called Code Llama, which it says is a Python specialized version. So this is a large language model which is specialized for Python programming. There is the URL for llama.com. So if you go to that web page, then you'll see these download links. If you click on one of the download links, then you'll find that there are versions of Llama for Windows and Linux and Mac, and it recognizes that I'm running a Windows box, so it's offering to download the Windows program for me, and it will run on Windows 10, which is good because that's what I'm running, but it will also run on Windows 11 if that's what you wish. The documentation is not the greatest, I don't think, in this web page. You have to go to the blog, and then you'll find some instructions under this Windows preview page. But they're pretty straightforward. You probably guess what you have to do. Download the executable, and then just double click on the .exe file, and it will install. And sure enough, if you do that, you download that .exe file, you double click on it, this dialog box comes up, and it's ready to go. Just click install, and off it goes. And off it goes with a progress bar, and eventually that progress bar reaches 100%, and it returns to your home screen, desktop. The question is, there's a lot of icons here, which nobody will appreciate that there's no icon there for a llama, but I recognize this is my desktop, and I recognize that there is no large language model icon has been added to the page here, to the desktop. Or is there? If you go down to the taskbar, and down in the bottom right-hand corner, you have the chevron for everything else, and you notice that there's a little llama icon in there. So the llama is actually running on my PC, but it apparently is running in the background. So if I go back to that blog and find the instructions, it turns out that once you install llama, it's running in the background all the time. And you notice here it says, open the terminal and run llama to get started. So that's basically, you want to run it, then you have to run a command line, a command window, which is the terminal in Linux. The Windows version should say open a command prompt, a command window, and then you can issue commands to make the thing run. So the question is, what's this little llama icon doing in the also runs? But it does have a couple of options, and you can look at logs. And if you want to shut a llama down, remember it's always running in the background. If you want to shut it down, then you have the option here to quit a llama. Anyway, once it's running in the background, what do we do? Well, we go back to that blog again, and we find that after installing, open your favorite terminal. And again, it's thinking of Linux, lots of different terminals available. But in Windows, we want to run a command prompt, and then we want to issue this llama run llama 2 to run a model, to run the llama 2 model. Now, remember, we don't want to run a general model. We want the Python specific one. And just a reminder that they have this code llama, which is a specialized large language model for Python. So we need to find that. So let's go back to the homepage for llama, and you'll see this link to models. And when you click on models, you'll find that there's a whole bunch of large language models available. Here's llama 3.1, the latest and greatest. There's one called Gemma. And there's a whole bunch. If you scroll down, there's a whole bunch. But you can also search the thing or filter things by name here. So let's try that. Let's put in code llama or code L. And the first one pops up is code llama, which is, I think, what we're looking for, the Python-specific large language model. And you notice that there are a whole bunch of different versions. There's a 7B, which is a 7 billion parameter model, a 13 billion parameter model, 34 and 70 billion parameter models. Now, I'm running this thing on a laptop, so I'm going to start off by running the 7 billion model because that's the smallest, and that's probably the one that's going to run on my machine. But if I wanted one of the other ones, notice here there's a drop-down. So I could click on this drop-down, and I could select the 13 or the 34 or the 70, and there's also a whole bunch more down here, which would give me the code llama, for example, and so forth. So let's say I want the code llama, I want the 7 billion parameter model, and the thing it's telling me, if I want to do that, remember I use that llama run and then the model name, so I want to llama run code llama. That's how I get my Python-specific 7 billion parameter large language model running. So here we go. Here we've opened up a Windows command prompt. I've issued the command llama run called llama. It started pulling all kinds of information down out of the system and loading things. And eventually, these are progress bars. It's not really a white box. It's various progress bars as the thing continues. And eventually it says success. So it's now installed the large language model, and this is now running on my PC. And now it says send a message. So it's looking for a command now to actually do something. So let's give it something really simple. And let's write a Python program to compare two files, to compare file fox01.txt to fox02.txt and output any lines that are different. So that's my task. So going back to the command window, I say llama run code llama, and then I give it the write a Python program to compare the files. And off we go. And here you can see it starts generating code with open fox01.txt, yada, yada. And if we give it a little time, then it will complete that. It will give us some Python code, and it gives us an explanation of what's happening. Now, normally, when you run a large language model on the web, it's kind of instant. This is what happens when you run it locally. So, as I run the video, you'll see I enter the command, and then you'll see the large language model working on my laptop PC in real time. Don't blink, or you may miss the output. I'm burning up Ontario's electricity supply as we wait for the code to be generated. It's running a fourth generation i7, Core i7 chip, Intel chip. It's got 16 gig of RAM. It's running on SSD. So it's not a slouch, this computer, but it's probably not the fastest computer in the world either. But this is pretty slow. I find this pretty slow. I don't know about everybody else. The good news, I think, is that these are early days, and maybe as we get faster hardware and better large language models, things will improve, and even local large language models more sophisticated and hence run a lot of loops through all kinds of other things. Okay, so here's the output. If you remember, we got the Python code. But we also got some other interesting things, and Chris was talking about AI hallucinating. Well, this local AI chatbot is hallucinating a little bit, although it's actually telling the truth. It says you can also use the diff lib module to compare the files, and it says you would use something like difflib.sequencematcher as a class. And you might use the find longest match method to do this file comparison. But the interesting thing is, although it has imported the difflib module for Python, it didn't change the code that it had in the first place. None of these commands that come from difflib are incorporated in this code. So yes, you could use difflib, but not by using that specific piece of code. So that's not exactly true. If you look at the difflib man page, then it talks about sequence matcher and find longest match, And you can see that the way that they're done is you have to have some Python code lines where a string is set to some form of sequence match based on strings. And then there's a string.find longest match option to do all kinds of things and pull something out. So none of those kind of lines are in the code that's suggesting that you can use for difflet. So that is a bit of a misnomer, if you like. And the second thing tells me is that you can also use the diff command in the terminal to compare the files. Well, that is true. Windows doesn't have a diff command, and if you remember, we download the Windows. I can use the diff command. Again, I can't use the diff command directly on Windows. So to me, that's a bit of a hallucination and not terribly helpful.
Alan, I wonder if you're breaking up a whole bunch again. I wonder if you turn off your video, whether it might help.
Okay, will do. Okay, let's try again. All right, so we did get some useful code. If you're not familiar with Python, this is saying with open, and it opens the file fox01.txt with R. That means open it as read only, so it read this file and open that file as this variable called F1. And then do the same thing and open fox2 as F2 for reading. And then it uses a for loop and it says for a line in the first file, if that line is not in the second file, then print the line. So it's looking for lines which are different between the two files, or from file one and file two, and then printing that different line. And sure enough, if I pull up a couple of files, so here's fox1.txt, the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog, and fox two, it becomes an extremely lazy dog. So I can take that code that was generated by the large language model, and I can drop it into PyCharm, which is an integrated development environment. So I have an editor in the top right-hand corner here where I paste in my code. I can edit that. I can save it. But I also have the option to run that code. And when I run the code, I'll get the output in this window right here. And you can see that what it's done is it's told me that the different line is jumped over the lazy dog. Now, because what happened is it found that line in file one, jumped over the lazy dog. It did not find that file in file two, so it decided that's a different line, and so it's printed it out. So it's kind of done pretty much exactly what I told it to, except I did ask for different lines, and it's only given me different lines when they're in one file. So it kind of works, but again, now you'd have to go in and try and refine that that program code by asking for more providing more information, giving a more detailed description of what you want to do, and basically build up the code as you go along. And that's as compared to if I were to run, let's say, ChatGPT, and give it exactly the same request, write the Python program to compare file 1 and file 2, Fox 1 and Fox 2. Well, he says, here's the Python script that does this and outputs the lines. And it also tells me how the script works. So it opens both files. It reads their contents into lists, so it creates an array for each file of the lines that are included in each file. And then it compares each line from both files. And so it's looking at both files for different lines, and it will print the differing lines. And it also, I didn't ask it to do this, but it also looks to see if the files are different lengths, because clearly it's going to have to stop working on one file if it runs out of lines. And then it says, you know, you can change the names of the file if you want to do something else. So it's a bit more flexible in the response here. And here's the actual code. Interestingly, it's written this in a way that I wouldn't have written it, but what it's done is it's prepared a function called compare files. And it's comparing files, file one and file two. And then this is the function that does that. But down the bottom here is the actual program. The program is one line. Call the function compare files and give it the arguments voxel1.txt and voxel2.txt. And then this compare files will do all the hard work. And here's what it's doing. It's with open file one, read only as F1. You've seen that somewhere before. Open file two as F2. Here's where it reads the lines. So it creates this array called lines one for file one, where it reads the lines, creates an array for lines two. It finds the maximum lines between those two, the lengths of those two files. So it's finding how many lines are in line one, how many lines are in line two, and then getting the maximum of those two. And then it runs a for loop for that range of maximum lines. So it's checking every available line in either of the two files. It finds a line one the array, the first line in the first file and the first line in the second file, and then it compares those. If that line is not equal to line two, then it found a difference, and it tells me there's a difference at line number something or other, and it writes those two lines out to the standard output device. So it's a much more involved program than was produced by the local large language model. Probably used a lot more of Ontario's electricity, but it gives you a much better result. And sure enough, here's the answer. If I do the same thing, if I take the ChatGPT version of the Python code, drop it into the editor and run it, here you see it says there's a difference at line two. First file had jumped over the lazy dog, and the second file jumped over the extremely lazy dog. So that's kind of what I was expecting. I get what I'm expecting out of ChatGPT instantly, and I'd have to do a bit of work on the local language model to derive the same piece of code. So that's kind of my quick and dirty on local large language models, and what do I conclude from all of the above? To have a super user, which is SU. At home here, I have an SU. It's called the spousal unit. And what I need is a bigger and faster computer. So I need to ask the spousal unit for permission to buy that great big machine, which will make this thing run really fast. But really, this Llama program, it turns out it's really easy to install. There's a lot of information on the web in terms of how-to tutorials and YouTube videos on how to do this, that, and the other. So you shouldn't be put off by trying to run a local version of a large language model on your computer. There's lots of help out there on how to do it. One of the things I found is that the actual running the local the local large language model is relatively slow. And so for me, I don't think it's ready for prime time, but it's good. I mean, it does the job. It produces answers. And if you had the time, if you wanted to spend the time, I'm sure you could make it generate exactly what you want. Local versions are not, they also may hallucinate. You notice that situation where it provided information about a library, but then didn't take any advantage of that library. And it was giving me Linux commands for what it should have known was a Windows system, which doesn't make much sense. The Python specific version of Llama 3, this code Llama, it does produce useful code, and I could see how you could generate snippets of how do you do this, how do you do that, and then you would go into the PyCharm IDE and basically put together all these snippets and build a real Python program. So the underlying question is it worth pursuing local large language models any further? And I leave that to you to ponder. I'm not sure that I will at this point. I may wait for a next generation of these things to see how they go. Okay, I think there were some questions there, Chris.
Yep.
I wasn't really following it, but I saw things popping by.
We did have from Greg, he asked, is the speed of the graphics card play a role? And Tom actually looked it up, and turns out that Olama does use your GPU automatically if it is of a sufficient vintage, I guess. And they say that GPU support, Olama supports NVIDIA GPUs with a compute capability 5.0 or higher, which didn't mean an awful lot to me. I happen to have an RTX 3070 Ti, and I looked it up, and it actually has a compute capability of 8.6. So it sounds like if I was to use it, it would actually use that GPU to presumably speed things along quite well. Or improve the situation at least. I suppose
I think that might be an issue here. Laptop does have a GPU. The laptop is about 9 years old, I think, so it probably predates all that high performance stuff. I don't know. I haven't checked that. I just ran Olama and CodeLlama as provided. I didn't try and tweak any settings, for example.
It'd be interesting, too, on yours there, Alan, just to see when it's answering a query, if you were to bring up Task Manager and see, you know, is the CPU at 99%, you know, is it reading and writing from disk an awful lot? I know that the parameter files for that are in the gigabytes, so it could be doing an awful lot of reading from your, even though you got an SSD. If it's still reading an awful lot, that might be slowing it down as well. Interesting. Bob Harris says, very interesting, and he doesn't understand most of it, but he found it interesting. Glenn asks, can you tell us the name of the integrated Python development environment that you used in the demo?
Yes, it's called PyCharm, P-Y, okay. PyCharm, and I use the community edition, which is the free version. There's also a paid version of PyCharm, which is meant for real Python developers. I don't consider myself a Python developer, so I use the community edition of PyCharm.
Okay, Elizabeth comments, I guess we're all in the early days of local LLM. And that is kind of interesting because I remember, within the last year, some talk about whether LLMs could run locally. And at the time, it was largely thought to be impossible, everybody sort of recognized that some abilities to do this processing locally could be possible. And Microsoft is actually doing that in some of their latest versions of Windows 11. With Copilot enabled PCs. And I don't think they're actually doing any of the local processing yet, but that is the aim, is that there will be ability to do some AI stuff locally without offloading all of it to the cloud. But as you found out, Alan, it seems like offloading to the cloud in most cases is working an awful lot faster than trying to run it locally.
I think they're using a bigger computer than me.
Yes, exactly.
So I noticed Greg here is asking, did I install PyCharm or was it installed with Llama? I installed it separately. I installed Python, and then I installed PyCharm as an IDE to be able to program in Python. And indeed it is PyCharm, PyCharm, all one word.
Yeah, I think that's all the questions that I noticed in there. So if I miss something, by all means, chime in again. You can unmute yourself or throw it back into the chat, and we'll see if we can cover it off if I miss anything.
Okay, so we're up to the last 10. We're into the last 5, actually, last 6, I think. So I have a question. When I turned my video off, did the audio break up at all?
It did a little bit, but it seemed to be better. Kind of hard to tell for sure. At first, it seemed to be, it cured all the problems and then had a little bit of a breakup, but it didn't seem to be breaking up as much as it was before. So I think in the future, if you try that, we'll try and nail it down whether it's really helping or not.
I think I'm going to be calling Mr. Bell. I did the Bell check all the internet connection stuff out and everything passed with flying colors, but I'm having these pauses and things every now and again. It will drop the connection. So it looks like it's a Bell problem to me. Okay, does anybody have any other questions?
I think it's a spousal unit problem. You need a better computer.
Maybe I need a better router.
Could be.
So if anybody has any other questions, put them in the chat, or I guess we're into kind of an open mic session. Just open your mic and ask your question.
And while we're waiting for any to come in, Ed says there may be an issue with using GPUs in that if you run any programs or drivers other than official drivers meant for the GPU, your warranty may be void. This is the issue, I'm told, with anything related to Bitcoin mining. Interesting. I'd be surprised if they could actually stand on any leg for just if you use unofficial drivers, but one would think that the drivers that the manufacturer provides are probably, going to be the best in most cases. NVIDIA does come out with drivers on a monthly basis. So if you are on an NVIDIA GPU, it's not a bad idea to check monthly or so and update the drivers. We did have a question. Is Perplexity AI better than Copilot ChatGPT? Personally, I can respond. My experience with it is that I think it's getting all the information from ChatGPT. So Copilot is also using ChatGPT as the back end. Perplexity does a really, really nice job of summarizing the information. And so much better than I was getting when I just go straight to ChatGPT. And I've tried Copilot a few times, and I find that the way that Perplexity AI summarizes the information, it's my go-to now. It's almost replaced Google as my search engine of choice. I still use Google for a lot of purposes, but it's almost gotten to the point where I'll just go to Perplexity and use it.
I have a question about Zoom Workplace. I'm house sitting right now, so I don't have my 3 other monitors working to show everything, and I'm on a single screen. And I find I can reduce the slide control and my mouse wheel, so I can see all of the slide. But then it goes back to filling as much of the screen as it can. And on the left side, I have the chat, and on the right side, I have the participants. Is there any way I can actually have the Zoom part?
Like in a separate window, or?
No. It's apparently, at least on my computer, it's a full HD display. When I opened the chat, I moved it to the left, and the participants show on the right, and the slide shows in the middle. And I can reduce the slide so it all shows, but then every minute or so, it goes back to the full size, which is slightly obscured. I did it just now, slightly obscured by the participants. And the lower boundary and the chat. And is there any way I can actually pin the Zoom?
I've never had the problem of resizing things on me, just for, and I don't know why, but if you go onto the Zoom view menu at the top, I have mine in side-by-side gallery.
And of course, you're using a 4K, correct?
Yeah, but even if I size the window, the Zoom window down to, you know, the size of a standard HD screen, it doesn't resize the slides. Mm-hmm. It'll resize down to whatever window that I've sized it to, and it doesn't change its size at all on that. And all I can say is my current settings for view is side-by-side gallery. And then on the right-hand side, it will have the two columns, one of which is the gallery of participants, and then the other one, I have the chat in a column on the right-hand side. So I don't know if that would help if you can duplicate that of going into side-by-side gallery view, whether that works. Does anybody else have a different view mode and not having a resize problem?
I wondered if Tom was aware that you can detach the boxes from the chat and participants. You can detach them from the main screen and then float around wherever you want.
I might still have the same problem. I suppose that would work because I could put the slide in its own window and then move things around. So that would be a solution. I just find it perplexing, should I say, especially with such a common screen size. And I was just using the standard view, and I tried out the other views, and they still have the same problem in that the actual slide gets obscured very slightly. I mean, it's maybe a quarter inch on the right side and a quarter inch on the left side because it's obscured by the chat. I moved the chat to the left side.
What you should do, Tom, is ask Perplexity AI how to do what it is you want to do. Greg's had his hand up for a little while, so can we go to Greg?
Yes, my hand is numb now. Just kidding. So I don't know exactly what you're trying to achieve, Tom, but what I'm doing, because I like to have full screen. I just have one screen, so I like to have the slides in two-thirds of the screen, and then I like to have the chat on the side. So what I do is I don't have the window fully open. It's like mid-size. On the top right, you know, you can have it fully. I'm just gonna find the exact words. Next to the X, I don't have the words, but next to the X, there's a square. So I don't make it full size. I make it reduced size. Then I open my chat. And once everything fits how I want it, I explode it to have it full screen. And
Greg, would you like to share your desktop and just show people to be able to see how things are laid out?
Sure, I'll try.
Okay, I'll make you a co-host. And yes, so you should be able to share your screen. And if you share the entire desktop.
Okay, I'll try. How do I have to remove the short chat? I'll remove just like that, I guess. Okay. So now I'm not full size right now. I add the chat. I guess it remembers now.
Could you share your desktop?
You have to share your desktop like twice. You have to choose which one and then hit the share button.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. How is it now? Again?
Not yet.
Share screen.
Yeah, once you choose the screen, you then have to click the share button down at the bottom.
Share at the bottom. Okay. Oh, okay. I think I know what you mean. Share.
There we go. And there we go. So we're seeing snipping tool.
Okay.
I was sharing a window.
Yeah, actually, at the top, you should have the ability to... Do you have multi-monitor?
No, I just have one screen. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So all we're seeing is snipping tool full screen.
Okay.
What happens if you minimize snipping tool?
That's going to be what's behind.
Okay, now we're seeing a web browser.
Yeah.
You have to highlight the zoom picture on your desk, wherever you're showing the zoom.
This gets really confusing when
now we've got the desktop. Yeah. So I think if you hit the zoom button down there on the taskbar, we'll get that.
Oh, okay, like that, yeah. Oh, I'm trying. Now you're seeing the win. Okay, you're seeing the
just seeing the desktop.
Okay.
Now it could be that the Zoom controls tend to be hidden. They don't get shared out, and so I wonder if it's really
that.
No, we're still just seeing the desktop. I think it's that Zoom doesn't want to share itself. I think that's a problem with Zoom.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't think we're going to be able to actually do this.
Okay. Sorry, guys.
Greg, one of the things you could do is if you want to make some screenshots of how it appears us how to do it, you could provide a presentation for us on how to run Zoom.
There we go.
Okay, a very, very short presentation, sure.
That'd be great.
Okay.
He's got two Zooms. This one just barely sticking out. Maybe it's the other one that he needs to show the Zoom.
Yeah, try the bottom one, apps.
So I open that.
No, that, yeah, we don't see anything there.
Okay.
And the Zoom controls will always be hidden. They never get shared out if you choose the Zoom controls.
I think he just closed it.
Yeah, I think I closed it. Yeah. But it's
Anyhow, it's I don't think it's going to be all. It's Zoom is designed really to hide itself from being shared.
But it certainly works if you do screenshots.
Yep. Yeah. Screenshots would be great. So that'd be really good.
Okay. Great. All right. So if I share my screen now, there we go. So to finish off, let me just say that in September is just around the corner, our monthly meeting will be on the 11th, and we're going to have a presentation on building websites without using any HTML coding. So we'll see how that's done. And in the meantime, next week will be September the 4th. If you have any questions or you have any follow-ups on the things that we've talked about tonight, if you have any topics you'd like to share, like how to run Zoom and how to arrange all these windows and fly out control panels and all kinds of things, just send us a few details to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And we will be, as usual, be happy to put you on the agenda for September the 4th. So I hope everybody enjoyed tonight. Lots of interesting stuff, I hope. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for coming, folks. I will see you in about 3 weeks.